We're going to proceed now with the seventh chapter of Acts, and this represents a whole panorama of the implications of God's interaction in the world. Again, I have to come to you on this basis. We're a long way from God in one sense of the word. We believe He's in our spirits. We believe that. We have thousands of years of human history which are recorded for us in the context of God's interaction. If we did not have this Bible, all we could go on would be some kind of vague personal revelation. I shudder when I hear people over and over again saying that the Lord said this to me and He said that. And then worse, when people write all of their human musings down on paper and offer it to somebody as the Word of God, that's even worse. How many revelations have there been over the history of the world that have been written down and been offered as God telling me this or that? I can't imagine a human being conning the world or even taking responsibility for that kind of writing. For example, here's Muhammad. Muhammad wrote in about 600 AD, and his writings, which had no witnesses, nobody ever came forward to claim that there was a witness to his revelation. He didn't even claim it. He just said, he didn't claim to have witnesses. He claimed to have a revelation without witnesses. So he writes this book, which then became the basis for an orgy of bloodshed across Africa, which bloodshed he would be personally responsible for. Muhammad is personally responsible for the slaughter of thousands of people in the Middle East. Now you say, how can you blame Muhammad for that? Well, because Muhammad wrote a book in which he claimed to have a revelation from God, from Allah, that the Muslim people, his followers, the Arabs, the Ishmaelites, that is, those who were descendants of Ishmael, had the title to the land. In his revelation, the Quran, he claims that God tells him that killing infidels is a badge of honor. So the Muslim followers of Muhammad swept across North Africa with their Saracen blades and butchered thousands that were regarded by them as infidels. This is something that the Bible of the Muslim, the Quran, told them to do. And that was written by Muhammad alone. And he never claimed any other help except that it was a direct revelation from God. There were no proofs of his book. There was nothing to verify it with, because Muhammad offered no miracles, no prophecies, nothing that you could look at and say, this will prove it. If it doesn't happen, then we know he's a fake. If it does happen, he's real. Compared to Jesus, who did thousands of miracles in public and claimed to be God and set up himself the tests by which he could be verified. Thus he claimed that he would rise from the dead. He claimed many things that if they did not come true, his whole reputation would be sunk. If you said, for example, that God is going to come back, or Christ is going to come back on such and such a day, If that day comes and goes and Christ doesn't come back, you're disqualified. But that has been true down through the history of the world. People have risen up to claim divine capacities, and they've been short-lived because they just can't make it stick. How long can you make it stick that you're God? Now, there are people that run around and think that they are God's instrument. I understand that. And people go out and have healing meetings, for example, and they claim to heal. But you see, they've got an out. If it doesn't happen, they can always blame the victim. I mean, blame the person that came for the healing. They don't have to blame themselves. They never blame themselves. I've never heard one yet say, maybe I'm just not capable of doing this. If the thing fails, never. Have I ever heard one of these fellows say, well, I just don't have the gift. He says, well, you didn't have the faith. So they've always got an out. If you don't claim to be God, you don't have to perform at any given level. You can just blunder all you want. Now, Jesus claimed to be God, and he made it stick so that today, even those that don't follow him at least treat him with great respect. And yet he made all his claims. I'm pressing the point that Muhammad never claimed to be God, never claimed anything by which we can verify him. And yet, let me go on with it. His writings were the basis of the bloodshed that swept part of the Middle East and of Europe back in the 8th century. It was after his death, of course, but the Saracens were following the instructions of the Quran. Here we are seated in this building, and we want to know, what does God have to say? If we can't be sure God has said it, we're wasting our time. Go out to Magic Mountain, ride the roller coaster. But we believe that here is a book that God has presented to us that says some things in it that are valid. We think everything in it is valid. And so we read it and we follow it. But never in the New Testament context is a Christian ever told to go out and murder infidels. Some have done it. And you can hardly use their name without a curse. The Inquisition was a terrible blight on the faith, but it wasn't what God told them. God did not tell those Romans over there, the Roman Catholics, to butcher the Jews for not believing in Christ. They did it on their own. And they deserve whatever penalties God will put on them. It's a sad chapter in the history of the church. So we have a word here from God that we call a revelation. We don't, of course, claim to personally be given revelation from God. And even in the church today, where revelations are rampant in certain movements of the church, I deplore it to this day because of the threat that it poses to other believers who listen to that dribble. Because all it does is confuse people and elevate and give ego trips to the people that pronounce all that stuff, and causes much distress and harm to the body, because there are a lot of people who don't ever hear from God, and they think, therefore, they're substandard. What we're saying here today is preparatory to the 7th chapter of Acts, because we are going to be given in the 7th of Acts, via a message by Stephen, we're going to be given the panorama of the history of God's people. And we're going to find out from reading that brief thumbnail sketch what was regarded as important about the history of Israel. What I'm trying to do is lay a footing here by which we are now going to begin a bit of a trek through the ancient past of Israel. And we're going to weigh the difference between the revelation which has come to us from God in the Bible and the revelations which were claimed to be from God in that ancient past. This is all introductory, you understand. You can say, well, you're not telling me about the Bible. I've got to lay a foundation for you. You see, we're dependent on that book, the Bible, for life. And I've got to help you see why we have reason to depend on that Bible for life, as compared to all other writings. The average human being just waves his hand, oh, well, there were lots of revelations. You don't know anything if you say that. I mean, if you think that those revelations you're talking about were anything like the Bible, you haven't read one or the other. I don't know which. Because the writings of the religious culture of the Mesopotamian era were absurd as compared to the Bible. The Bible represents a stream of sanity that was completely unmatched in all of that era. There are things in the Bible we don't understand. There are things we may even look at and wonder about in the way of God's dealing with humanity. But the Bible is a paradise of sanity compared to the idiocies that were the culture of that day. Now, if you don't believe me, you go get in the libraries like I have done and read this stuff. If you want to spend the rest of your life poring through the ancient manuscripts of Mesopotamia and other places, and you want to read the Gilgamesh epic and the Babylonian epic and the Book of the Dead of the Egyptians, the Ka, you want to read all this stuff, you can do it. But you can save yourself a lot of time. I'll just tell you that it's chaos. And people worship their gods out of terror. I don't mean fear, I mean terror. If they didn't bring the right sacrifices, that they would not have any more crops. Because you see, people in those days were not conversant with the meteorological data, the astronomical data that we are relative to the weather and so forth. They were not meteorologists in those. They were astrologers. The astrologers have been with us ever since man first was able to utter some nonsense out of his lips. We've had astrologers with us. We had astronomers then, but I mean the science of astronomy is with us today. The whole Copernican revolution has given us reason to be confident in the cycles, the seasons. In those days, they didn't know that. When the land dried up and the ground got parched and the crops were dead, they didn't know if they'd ever get another rain in their life. They didn't know what the god, the sun god, or some god had frowned upon them and cursed their village, and they were going to all die. Every time the springtime left and the summer came and the land was parched, they would look at that, and they would think it was all over. Unless they pacified the gods, and they would smile upon them once again and bring the rain. We don't look at it that way. Even atheists today think that there's going to be a harvest time coming around again. So they had to placate the gods in whatsoever way the shamans, the priestly people of those days, suggested. If they told them they'd have to sacrifice a human, they sacrificed a human. In another happier vein than that, the whole fertility cult of the ancient past, which is probably the most prevalent element of the ancient religious system, were the fertility rites. They were symbolic. They were supposed to bring the harvest again. The god Baal and his paramour Ashtarte, she and he together were the god and goddess of the fertility cult, and it was practiced. The temple, prostitution, so forth, was the rampant thing in that day. Israelites got mixed up in it, unfortunately. A lot of this adultery that the Bible talks about goes back to the days of the grand fertility rites and prostitutions of the temple, with the idea that they had to bring in the rain with that, and the season of springtime and of harvest. I say to you, the whole system throughout the Middle East, the Bible in the midst of that culture is like a refreshing stream of water in the midst of the desert. It is so simple and so sane and so beautifully executed and so orderly. The language of it, even in the ancient Hebrew, even more beautiful in the English. If you could read the Hebrew, you'd find it far more beautiful, far more expressive than the English today. And the way you have to get it out of the... When you read that stuff in the King James or any translation, it reads like a Mack truck as compared to the ancient Hebrew language. Beautiful Hebrew language. So, the Bible, in that respect, is a marvelous, simple, beautiful stream of sanity in the midst of a world of chaos. But now, how do the Jewish people relate to that? See, how do they intermix with that whole thing? Where does the Bible come from in that complex? You understand in the first place that Abraham came from Ur of the Chaldees. Abraham came out of the middle of that civilization. Abraham was an Amorite, who were a basic racial entity that was prevalent in that day in that area. He was an Amorite. He lived in the city of Ur. Stephen says right here, "Men, brethren, fathers, hear ye. The God of glory appeared to our father Abraham when he was in Mesopotamia before he dwelt in Haran." We call it Haran. Haran was a very important mid-city between Ur and the Mediterranean Sea. It was a commercial center where the caravans all stopped on their way to Egypt. So Abraham went into Haran and dwelt there. And then he said, coming out of the land of Chaldea, he dwelt in Haran. But it says here before that, and God spake to him, come out of your land and from your kinsmen and come into the land which I will show you. If you look at all the religious instruction, all the cultic beliefs and concepts, the ancient world, and one would say, well, everybody has a national or ethnic religious bent, and that people have to manufacture gods and all that sort of thing. I was saying to you this. All the distortions that exist, have existed from that time to the present day, all the distortions of God and of religion go back to the original stream, which was pure. And these are distortions. Where did the idea of God come from in the first place? We're not that far from God, actually. You know, we sit here, and I recognize the distance. Human minds trying to capture the deity. But in a way, God has already bridged that gap. Because the idea is there. Think about that. The idea of God is there. We can talk about him intelligently. He has implanted in the mind of man the model, if you will. When we're talking about a model, we're talking about the pattern. He has implanted in the mind of man the pattern that makes thinking about God rational. understandable, meaningful. And even if you're talking to people who do not believe in God, they know what they do not believe. They do not say, don't talk about God, that's just sheer nonsense, nobody even knows what God is like. No, they're willing to talk to you about no God. I've told you that before, if you try to talk to somebody about something they've never seen before. Go down to some islands of the South Pacific, for example, where they've never seen snow in their life, and try to talk to them about snow. You can't even carry on a conversation. If they were to try to say to you, I want to prove to you there is no such thing as snow, they couldn't even talk about it because they don't even know what it is that they're trying to negate. And so it would be of any kind of an element of culture that one had never been exposed to by film or by narrative or anything else. They may not believe in God. They may think God is fantasy. They may think God is from the pits. They may think God is terrible. They may think anything you want about God, but any human being, if you use the generalization of a supreme spirit being, and you can talk to the Tlingit Indians about great spirit or whatever. You can talk about, could have talked to Babylonians about Tammuz or any of these things. But the point is that the mind of man has a matrix in it that says God and has a certain rudimentary sense of what God is. And what people do to the matrix is up to them, but it's there. Now, throughout the Middle Eastern culture, the ideas of God became distorted to the point of gross absurdity. And from that ancient stream of civilization came a man by the name of Abraham who had enough sensitivity in his head about godness that he could become the father of a race of mankind who had a view of God that was sane and personal and humanized only to the degree of being sane. Now, mortalized and humanized are two different things. The gods of Mount Olympus were mortalized and humanized to an absurd degree, to a useless degree as far as we're concerned. But anyway, the people of Greece, in those days, ancient Greece, thought of their gods up there as scrapping among themselves and being capricious and then coming and having relations on earth with human beings and so forth, physical relations. And they were a very sorry lot were these gods and goddesses of the ancient culture. The God of the Bible, Elohim, has an interaction with mankind, but the revelation about him does not give us that kind of weird picture. The qualifications, the characterizing of God in the Bible is worthy of the Master of the Universe. From day one of mankind on the earth to the present hour, there has been a prevailing stream in the mind of man of something of God. And in the Bible, that prevailing stream has been articulated and refined to show us that he is the kind of one that we can rely on and that makes our life more a thing of beauty, or a thing rather, not of beauty perhaps, but it makes our life more a thing of orderliness than the ancient gods who made of the life of the people something of chaos and terror. Now we're just getting into that a little bit, but I want to lay a foundation out here that will give us something to stand on when we say that we have before us the revelation that God has given. And when we compare it to other revelations, it comes out way, way ahead. If a person would say to me, how do you know the difference between the inspiration of the Bible, for example, and the inspiration of the Quran? It shows me something that they haven't read the Quran. I get it all the time. I'm not putting a person down for not having read it, but I am putting them down for comparing them when I haven't read it. You know, people say, well, how can you say the Bible's any better than any other book? They obviously haven't read the other books. Somebody wants to throw out the name Gilgamesh Epic, I'm going to say, go read it, and then come back and tell me how great it is and how much like the Bible. It isn't. It's absurd. Go read the Babylonian Epic. You're in a sandbox when you read it. We have a tremendous thing. Now, this relates to the matter of the Holy Spirit. Because you see, it is the Spirit of God, a maker of man, who has come to the Spirit of man with this revelation, with this presence that has been prevailing. God is a marvelous, magnificent, superb, superior intelligence as described by the Bible. If you ask yourself, well, how do we know the Bible is better than any other revelation? And I have to ask you, tell me which are the revelations you're talking about. What books claim to be universal revelations of God? The only ones that we want to consider would be the ones that claim to be the only revelation. If somebody wants to say, I have a revelation from God, we say, fine, go believe in it and leave me alone. If somebody says, unless you believe in our revelation, you're through, as far as God is concerned, then I'm going to ask some questions about it. I'm going to ask three questions. I'm going to ask about its universality. How widely is it circulated? If you've got a revelation that claims to be from God and only a million people know about it, it doesn't speak very well for the God of the universe. There are only three that emerge that qualify in any kind of universality. The Quran, the New Testament, the Old Testament. Now, since all three religions, Islam, Christianity, and Judaism, all three believe in the Old Testament, it's already accepted by 2/3 of the world's population. That's universal enough for me. And you have to ask the second question, what about its verifiability? Is there anything in it you can look at and say, if this isn't true, it's false? If this does not come out, then we can mark the thing as false. There's only one that qualifies. That's the Bible. The Old and the New Testament both qualify there. The Quran doesn't give us that verifiability. The third thing is accreditation. Who are the witnesses? There are thousands of witnesses in the Bible and thousands of witnesses to Jesus' actions, and the Bible was written by a large number of different people, all coming together in a unified book. The Quran was written by one person who never claimed to have witnesses, and who is not verified. It cannot be verified by any test that he has given us. So where are you at? But remember, people just generally think, oh, there are lots of revelations. There are not lots of revelations. There are revelations that are offshoots, offbeats, that have a few people that believe them. But when you ask the question, where do we find a universal revelation of God that has accreditation and verifiability, you're one place, the Bible.